From Third World to First, The Singapore Story. Authors, Lee Kuan Yew. From decolonization to globalization. The explosion of information has not been accompanied by a similar increase in knowledge. The continents interact, but they do not necessarily understand each other. The uniformity of technology is accompanied by an implicit assumption that politics and even cultures will become homogenized. Especially the long-established nations of the West have fallen prey to the temptation of ignoring history and judging every new state by the criteria of their own civilizations. Singapore is a case in point. As the main British naval base in the Far East, it neither had prospect nor aspiration for nationhood until the collapse of the European power, in the aftermath of the Second World War, redrew the political map of Southeast Asia. Character shapes events. In the case of Lee Kuan Yew, the father of Singapore's emergence as a national state, the ancient argument whether circumstance or personality shapes events is settled in favour of the latter. Circumstances could not have been less favourable. Singapore seemed destined to become a client state of more powerful neighbours, if indeed it could preserve its independence at all. Lee Kuan Yew thought otherwise. Annual per capita income has grown from less than $1,000 at a time of independence to nearly $30,000 today. It's the high-tech leader of Southeast Asia and the commercial entry point of the scientific centre. Lee Kuan Yew would not be true to himself if he were less than frank about the analysis of the difference between the individualism of the West and the priority for social cohesion in countries such as his. He does not ask us to change our patterns, but only to refrain from imposing them on societies with different histories and necessities. Going it alone. All of a sudden, on August the 9th, 1965, we are out on our own as an independent nation. We have been asked to leave Malaysia and go our own way with no signposts to our next destination. I had many pressing concerns. First, to get international recognition for Singapore's independence, including our membership in the United Nations, the UN. My next concern was to defend this piece of real estate. Many Malay leaders believe that Singapore should never have been allowed to leave Malaysia, but should have been clobbered into submission. My third and biggest headache was the economy, how to make a living for our people. How was an independent Singapore to survive when it was no longer the centre of the wider area that the British once governed as one unit? After pondering these problems and the limited options available, I concluded as an island city-state in Southeast Asia could not be ordinary if it was to survive. We had to make extraordinary efforts to become tightly knit, rugged and adaptable people who could do things better and cheaper than our neighbours because they wanted to bypass us and render us obsolete as our role as the entry point and middlemen for the trade of the region. Winning over the unions. I started my political life fighting for the unions as their legal advisor and negotiator. By the mid-1950s, the communists had gained control of most of them, and both communist and non-communist unions had turned combative. To attract investments, we had to free unions from communist control and educate union leaders and workers on the need to create new jobs by getting investments. At that time, there was too much exploitation of our workers, but the consequences were so bad, adding to our unemployment, that I regretted having done this. For example, triple pay on public holidays had led to cleansing workers deliberately allowing garbage to accumulate before public holidays to ensure that they would have to work on these days. The purpose of public holidays was to give workers leisure, but our workers wanted more pay, not more leisure. So I asked union leaders to update our trade union practices. Many tongues, one language. Singapore never had one common language. The government provided a limited number of English language schools to train people to be clerks, shopkeepers, draftsmen and such subordinate workers. And Malay language primary schools for Malays, Indians ran their own Tamil and other Indian language schools or classes. The Chinese set up schools financed by successful members of their community to teach Chinese. As an international trading community, we would not make a living if we used Malay, Chinese or Tamil. With English, no race would have had an advantage, but it was too sensitive an issue for us to make immediate changes, so we left the position as it was, with four official languages, Malay, Chinese Mandarin, Tamil and English. Managing the media. It took many years before younger generation of journalists in the 1980s recognised that the political culture of Singapore was and will stay different from the Western norm. However, our journalists are exposed to and influenced by the reporting styles and the political attitudes of the American media, always sceptical and cynical of authority. The Chinese and Malay press do not model themselves on the newspapers in the West. Their cultural practice is for constructive support of policies as they agree with and criticism in measured terms when they do not. By the 1990s, our journalists aged below 40 had all gone through similar Singapore schools, yet difference between the English, Chinese and Malay press continue. The cultural gap has not been bridged. Conductor of an orchestra. I had an easy relationship with my colleagues. I was able to put my views on matters within their portfolios without ruffling their feathers. At the end of the day, they knew that I would have to stand before the voter to persuade them to give us a mandate for another term, and I needed a convincing case to present. Passing the baton. My experience of developments in Asia has led me to conclude that we need good people to have a good government. On the other hand, I have seen several societies well governed in spite of poor systems of government because good, strong leaders were in charge. I have also seen many of the over 80 constitutions drafted by Britain and France for their former colonies come to grief, and not because of the flaws in the constitutions. It was simply that the preconditions for the democratic system of government did not exist. The single decisive factor that made for Singapore's development was the ability of its ministers and the high quality of the civil servants who supported them. Whenever I had a lesser minister in charge, I invariably had to push and prod him, and later review problems and clear roadblocks for him. The end result was never what could have been achieved. When I had the right man in charge, a burden was off my shoulders. I needed only to make clear objectives to be achieved, time frame within he much tried to do it, and he would find a way to get it done. It was Singapore's good fortune that we had, for a small developing country, a fair share of talent because our own had been reinforced by the talented men and women who came here for their education and stayed on for employment or business opportunities because of our relentless and unceasing search for talent both at home and abroad to make up for the small families of the well-educated, Singapore has been able to keep up its performance. Our greatest task was to find people to replace my aging ministers and myself.